Welcome back to Cairo Nights. I am Mike Lewis. Coming up, we're going to have just another few minutes, we're going to have Melissa Santos on the show. She is the Crosscut's political writer, and she's going to hear to talk about Lauren Culp. If you've not heard of him, you've not been doing much driving outside of Seattle. He's the current police chief of Republic Washington. He's also the department's only employee. He's a grandfather, and he's a Republican nominee for Washington governor. She's going to talk to us about Lauren, about the upcoming debate with Governor Jay Inslee this coming Wednesday. She and four other journalists are going to be remote moderators of that debate. And like I said, if you were listening before the commercial break, they do have mic off switches, so they will be able to shut down any bad behavior, although I suspect at a state level we won't see what we saw in the national debate. First, some good news about the coronavirus. This is from Gene Bulk, the Seattle Times FYI guy, and he's a guy who takes a lot of news stories, and he breaks down what the numbers are actually telling us. It's super interesting, regular feature in the paper, really worth reading. And this is about the coronavirus and about our area, and it looks like it's pretty decent news at this moment in time. Obviously, no, we are not breaking the tape. We are not doing any end zone celebrations at this particular juncture. But it says, he goes back to the beginning of the virus outbreak. And how everyone started having these rapid increases. And, of course, much of it in the country, we believe, started here and started in Kirkland at a nursing home. Although there are reports now that it likely started in a variety of places simultaneously, that certainly is the most well-known situation, and it blossomed here very, very quickly. But he says this, by the end of March, it was clear the virus was not spreading as quickly here as it was in the New York area, which became, remember, we were the first hotspot, New York immediately subsumed that or assumed that as the hotspot. In some other parts of the country, our hospitals, though stretched thin of personal protective equipment, were not overwhelmed to the same degree. And weirdly enough, we've kept that spread in check. In total, through the end of September, Seattle has recorded just shy of 5,600 cases, with the city's population of roughly 750,000. That pencils out to a rate of 7.4 cases per 1,000 Seattle residents. And if you compare that to New York, for example, 239,000 cases. Now, there's a lot more people there, but check this out. It's the rate there. Remember, ours is 7.4 cases per 1,000. New York's was 28.7, four times the rate of the of a little less than four times, just slightly under four times the rate per 1,000 city residents. And so This is the issue locally, that we've done a pretty decent job. Now, you can blame the governor if you care to, or you can credit the governor if you care to. But I think that people in this area generally did a pretty decent job, it appears, of the mask enforcement. As a person who was on the pointy end of the business closure issues, all of that stuff, I'm guessing, probably did. The way all the local stores immediately adopted pretty strict spacing rules, pretty strict mask rules, that kind of stuff. I think you can find, again, depending on what you believe about in the coronavirus, I think you can find a decent correlation between the places that were the most careful and the spread rates. Now, New York, because of its dense population, it's a difficult place to ever... I mean, if you've done any walking there at all, if you've spent any time in Central Park, and that's a big urban park, it is difficult to stay away from people. If you feel that level of stress here in town about how when you're going down the sidewalk and you see someone coming toward you, and should you clear more space for them? Do you need to put your mask back on if you haven't had it on? All of those things that you run into in parking lots and at school and things like that. Imagine adding that many more people to your sidewalk, where you can't actually easily cut out into the street or get on the other side of the sidewalk or cross the street, and all those things that people in Seattle can do pretty easily, or many people in Seattle can do pretty easily. In New York, it's a much, much more difficult thing. And so the mayor, Jenny Durkin, whose staff is compiling the coronavirus data from local health departments for the 30 largest U.S. cities, they found that that it looks like we are doing we're doing pretty well. This is from Stephanie Formas. She's the chief of staff to Durkin. She says, quote, the mayor meets, and this is in Gene's story, the mayor meets every week with a group of national experts that she's convened. And one of the conversations that we've focused on are the trends across the country. The mayor was interested to see how Seattle compares to other major cities. And it turns out, well, at least at this point, Seattle is comparing pretty well. And I guess, you know, for all the bad coronavirus news, it's nice every now and then to get some good coronavirus news. And it looks like we have Melissa on the line right now. Thank you for joining Cairo Nights.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So let's talk first, before we get into the debate issues coming up in a couple of days, on the 7th, I think, is when the debate is. You read Lauren's book. He's been selling it at campaign stops. Tell us a little bit about Lauren Culp for people who don't know his background.
Well, this is a police chief in a town of 1,100 people, Republic, Washington. That's in Ferry County in northeastern Washington, a pretty rural area. And he has not been in elected office before. He gained attention, though, 2 years ago when he decided he was not going to enforce, as police chief, a gun law that was approved by Washington voters. So that was 1639, which bans the sale of semi-automatic rifles to people under 21 and requires some stronger background checks as well. So he said he wasn't going to enforce that, particularly the, you know, not selling guns to young people, a portion, saying that was a violation of rights. And that got him a lot of attention at the time. I think he was possibly the first law enforcement officer to say that before other sheriffs followed. So he was on Fox News. He was on, he had some of these national interviews, some of them with some of the conservative networks, but also elsewhere. And, you know, then he wrote a book about it. You know, he wrote a book about why he made that decision, why he thought the law was unconstitutional, and then he said he was going to run for governor. And that's pretty much his entire political resume, basically.
He
right
is
there. So
he is. I've seen quite a few times over the last month or so, you head up to do maybe a bit of cycling, mountain biking, or a bit of hiking, or something like that, out in the eastern part of the state or in the central part of the state, and you see a lot of Lauren Culp signs. How did he manage with a guy with very low profile? Was it really based on this one stand he took against the Second Amendment? I mean, did he prove to be a decent fundraiser? I mean, how did he move to the top of a ticket in a state that typically has kind of well-vetted party candidates, and he certainly doesn't fit that bill?
Well, a few things happened. One, there was not a candidate that was sort of in the traditional Republican mold in Washington State for governor candidates, that no one stepped up who was in that mold. You know, they tried to recruit the state party and other Republicans, some sort of Puget Sound, more moderate folks, and they said, nah, I'm not gonna do that. So, you know, there wasn't sort of a clear Republican candidate early on. You had a serious five-way primary among Republicans with a sort of all these people who, you know, no one had really coalesced around. So that's part of why Lauren Culp was able to prevail in that, because he only got about 17% of the vote in the primary. It might have ticked up a little bit over time. So it wasn't some overwhelming, you know, vote from Republicans either, necessarily. But, you know, I will say he has a really big following on Facebook. I mean, this was actually a big factor, I think. He does these Facebook Live videos, and, you know, we in our state don't allow political ads on Facebook anymore from candidates. So if you have 20,000 people who tune into your video when no one else can advertise on Facebook, that's actually kind of a big thing.
Right.
You know, so he was able to kind of build up and use that support during the pandemic, I think, too, although he holds rallies in person as well. But I think that was a factor, you know, his sort of grassroots social media following. And I think people also feel strongly about guns in Washington State, genuinely. I mean, kind of being a Western state, a lot of people, you know, even people who are liberal a lot of the times, you know, grew up hunting and feel pretty strongly about that. So I think that is an issue that resonates with people.
We're talking with Melissa Santos, political reporter for Crosscut. She is going to be moderating the debate between Republican candidate Lauren Culp and Governor Jay Inslee, a Democrat. Melissa, what is Lauren Culp's platform? What should people be looking for when he squares up against the governor? I know there's a little bit of contentiousness about even setting up a debate between the two parties, but what are people going to be seeing from, or should they be expecting from Lauren Culp and him? Sort of, this is his first big chance to get in front of a lot of different people who maybe don't know who he is.
Right. Well, it's interesting you ask that, because I also was thinking, you know, we really need to talk about the issues here, obviously. So we have a story coming out tomorrow that kind of compares the candidates on, you know, their platforms in different areas. I do think you're going to hear a lot about COVID-19 restrictions and Culp being very much against how the governor has handled that. He basically says that people are free people and the government should not be ordering them to stay home, should not be issuing mandates for them to wear masks. And, you know, that was something when I talked to people at his rallies, and I went to a couple of them, that was really something a lot of people, certainly who are his fans, think is really important. Like, why are businesses shut down? My small business is hurting. My friend's small business is hurting, you know, particularly in rural areas. I think that haven't been as hard hit by COVID in some cases. Like, for instance, Ferry County is a little bit lower, incidence of infections. I think that maybe it feels less tangible why the restrictions are in place. And I think that the frustration might be greater in some of those areas. So you'll hear a lot about that. And Inslee saying, I assume, he's been pretty adamant that, you know, some of these restrictions are necessary to keep the virus from spiraling out of control. So there's going to be disagreement on that. There might be some discussion of gun control, but there's just so many issues, and they're both pretty well established as opposite ends of the spectrum on that. Inslee has supported, he wants to see a ban on assault weapons and, you know, high capacity magazines for guns, which is very different from Lauren Culp. And yeah, they're going to disagree on spending as well. You know, some of the traditional things where Culp is very anti-tax, anti-regulation. The governor, Governor Inslee, I think he has proposed taxes in the past quite a bit. And I think he'll do so again this coming year, probably. So, you know, they also just really disagree about Black Lives Matter, too. So I do think that that will be something that comes up, Yeah, but Governor Inslee was saying recently, he hears the protesters, Black Lives Matter. He's repeated that, and you know, as a statement of values. And Lauren Culp has said he thinks that statement is racist. So they're very different on that.
So when we get to, so let's move it forward then to debate. I mean, I think Lauren Culp has proven to be maybe a little stronger campaigner, perhaps, than the Democrats expected. And like you said, I've read a bit about his presence on Facebook, which is impressive for somebody who was largely unknown. If I remember your story correctly, as police chief, he only had one officer. It was a pretty small police department.
Well, I mean, actually, right now he is the only.
He is the only officer
right now. But yeah, I mean, because at its peak, he had one person he supervised, and then that person actually has been in and out. You know, if there's been times where he has been the only guy. So yeah, it is a big jump from the police department of one or two to the state of 7.6 million people.
Right. So when we get to the debate stage, it's going to be remote. I think that was the insistence of the governor, that he didn't want to be in the same room, just mm-hmm. right, for ostensibly for health reasons. When we see them actually together, how is the whole debate going to play out? I mean, you're a moderator, so are they going to be getting questions? Are they going to be making statements? I mean, what should we look for?
We are going to be asking questions. We're not going to just let them get up and you know, say their campaign speech, you know, just without any prompting or pushback. But, you know, it is going to be way different than, you know, I moderated a debate with the U.S. Senate race for our state in 2016. And yeah, we were all in the same room. You know, the moderators were close together. And this time, the governor is in his own room, and Lauren Culp is in his own room, and the moderators are in a different room, spaced out a bunch. So it is going to be a little bit different. We're going to we're all in the same building for logistical purposes, I guess, and typing in that many feeds would have been difficult, I guess. But we're just not near each other. However, you know, there is a sense that you have to follow the rules of the debate. Just because a moderator isn't in the same room as you, you know, the control room can mute microphones. You know, there's, you know, we're going to try and keep it to the rules here and not let people go over time and all of those things. So we're going to try and make it like a normal debate as much as possible, even though none of us are looking at each other except through a screen.
Right. And well, that's an interesting point, because obviously people are still probably a little... have a little bit of post-traumatic stress from the presidential debate, which was a bit of a disaster in terms of that. So you'd said, you did mention, you specifically mentioned that you're going to have mic control as a moderator. Right. So that's at least, although I don't imagine those two would get quite as contentious.
I think though too, well, there's four of us actually moderating. So, I mean, I think the control room's going to kind of handle that, and we'll have signals back and forth maybe if things are getting out of control. But I think that they're, us as a group, at least someone nearby is going to have the ability to turn off mics, even if it's not me specifically pushing the button.
Let me not be remiss, and who else is going to be moderating along with you?
Brandy Cruz from Q13, right. Chris Daniels from King 5, and Essex Porter from Cairo are also moderating. So there's four of us. So that's, a big group of moderators, too. So it's a big, fun, socially distanced crowd.
And what time is the debate going to be on?
It is at 8 p.m. on Wednesday. And, yeah, you can watch it on TBW, which is a state public affairs network. It'll be live streamed. It'll also be broadcast on I think, all of the local networks, and I think posted on a lot of their websites as well as it is happening.
Okay, great. That is Melissa Santos, political reporter for Crosscut. She is going to be one of the five moderators for this week's gubernatorial debate on Wednesday. Make sure you listen to it. Melissa, thank you very much for your time.
Hey, thank you.
Coming up right after the break, we have Clark Lombardi, University of Washington law professor, who's going to tell us about the 25th Amendment. If you don't know what it is, here's what it is. It's the line of succession amendment that everyone has been talking about. He's going to give us a little primer so we actually understand what we're talking about when you hear all this noise about the 25th Amendment. Hopefully, it's something we don't have to worry about, but Clark's going to tell us what we do have to worry about should we get there. Coming up after the break, and after that, we'll be talking to Stacey Joe about the Dolphins game, and you can find out how well a listener stacked up with his predictions against Stacy's predictions. That will be at 9 o'clock. Join us then. To Cairo Nights. There has been a lot of discussion, obviously, about the president's health since Friday over the course of the weekend, and today it looks like the president was going to be returning home, or has returned home, I think at this point, to the White House after a stay in Walter Reed. He's still being treated for COVID, for his COVID-19 infection, as are some other upper officials in the White House. But when this happened, a lot of discussion started focusing on the 25th Amendment of the Constitution. The 25th Amendment deals essentially with what happens if your president becomes ill or potentially dies while in office, or resigns, or leaves office for some reason. Joining us right now is law professor Clark Lombardi, an expert on constitutional law. Clark, thank you for joining us on Cairo Nights. And what does the 25th Amendment actually tell us that should happen should a president get incapacitated in office?
It's quite a long amendment, and it deals with a couple of eventualities. One is it suggests that that if the president knows he's or she is about to be incapacitated, that he or she will hand over power to the vice president, who then will act as acting president until the president, in writing, asks for all the power back. And that's the easiest situation. The 25th Amendment then tells us if a president is either unable or unwilling to deliver that paper because they were in an accident, because they decide they don't want to give up power, then the vice president and a majority of the cabinet can either speak where the president did not speak or even override the president's wishes and take power from the president, declaring the president to be incapacitated. And that, if that happens, then the vice president will be president until the president, in writing, demands that the power be granted back to them. They can do it or not. And if they choose to, if the vice president is in a disagreement with the president, then it has to go to the Congress to be resolved. That's pretty much what the amendment says.
We're talking with Clark Lombardi, a University of Washington law professor, on the constitutional law, and also we're talking about the 25th Amendment. So the president, if the president now is on the mend, the 25th Amendment concern isn't really an issue, unless, of course, that there is, you know, some objections, or the president objects to the turnout, to the election, should he not get a turnout that he hopes for in the election. In the past, when has the 25th Amendment been invoked? A line of succession been declared? I mean, obviously, with the couple of assassinations, I assume that was the case. When else?
Well, the question of succession is a separate one. And I only say that because the 25th Amendment only deals with what happens when the president becomes ill or incapacitated, or in the minds of other people has become ill or incapacitated. It doesn't deal with the question of what happens if the vice president. The 25th Amendment doesn't tell us what happens if the vice president also becomes ill or incapacitated. And that has been addressed in a statute called the Succession Act. Congress has enacted a law that says what's supposed to happen.
So if we have, so for example, when Richard Nixon resigned in 1974 and Gerald Ford became president, Gerald Ford had actually become vice president prior to that, because the vice president actually resigned for tax evasion, right, and I think a couple of other things prior to that. Yeah. And so Gerald Ford went in 8 months from being a member of Congress to being president of the United States. In fact, I think are still only never elected president in U.S. history. When we're talking about the 25th Amendment, then, as it applies to the president, is there a point at which, let's just say that the president is being treated for COVID-19, who decides then whether or not power should be temporarily moved over to Vice President Mike Pence during treatment or not? I mean, again, it sounds like he's at least to some degree past a lot of that sort of early concern, although we really don't know because the information has been conflicting. Who makes the decision on that on that transition of power, even if it's a temporary one, if the president is being treated for an illness?
Ideally, it's the president himself. So when Ronald Reagan went into surgery, he wrote a paper giving power over to his vice president, Vice President Bush, and then took it back when he came out of surgery. Then that's the easiest case. In circumstances, as I said, in which the president is either unable because he's suddenly struck with some incapacitating illness, or is unwilling because they simply like holding power, then the 25th Amendment says that the vice president, with a majority of his cabinet, can take power from the president. That's what it says.
That's what it says. All right. So that would be the situation in that case. If the president was going to be incapacitated, the president decided, no, you know, even though I'm going to be in, you know, under anesthesia or in surgery, I would still like to retain presidential powers. He can be overridden by a vice president.
He can't. And a majority of the cabinet.
And a majority
of
the cabinet.
They have to act in concert.
All right. So when you were watching all of this play out, the president and getting infected with coronavirus, did you ever anticipate that it would actually come to any sort of real serious discussion like this? Or did you anticipate, well, this is probably just, you know, a lot of television bloviating on the 25th Amendment and it's really not something we need to worry about? What were your thoughts?
No, I think this is something we really need to worry about. If one looks in the British case, when Prime Minister Johnson had COVID-19, he moved from being ambulatory and moving around to being hospitalized and intubated and completely incapacitated in a very, very quick time. So I think when I saw that the president was, first of all, had tested positive at all, but certainly when he went to the hospital, I thought this is time for people to start thinking about whether what the 25th Amendment says and what procedures should be in place so that it can be invoked if necessary.
And is there anything with the 25th Amendment? I mean, last question, do you feel like that is left, unfortunately, too vague or too nonspecific for it to be sort of an effective plan B should something happen to the president? Or do you feel like it's pretty clear and it seems to be well engineered to handle, you know, one of these sort of variables?
Now, there's a lot. I mean, there's a lot that is not addressed. And for one, if there actually gets to be a fight between the president and vice president and his cabinet. But if a president insists that they want to keep power and other people would like to override it, the 25th Amendment says that if that fight continues, it has to go to the Congress and the Congress has to resolve it. Right. That would be a very messy procedure.
Right. Absolutely.
And we don't know exactly how it would play out. But the bigger issue at a time like this, in which you appear to have a debilitating disease moving through the White House and through people who have been in contact with both the president and the vice president, is that the 25th Amendment does not address the question of succession if both the president and vice president are to be incapacitated. As I said, there is a statute, but there are a lot of questions about whether that statute is constitutional at all. And if it is, whether everyone is willing to follow it. It's the question of succession, if you have both a president and a vice president ill, is one that is very murky and can be really bad.
That is Clark Lombardi, law professor at the University of Washington, expert on constitutional law. Clark, once again, you're becoming a regular visitor on the show. We really appreciate it here at Cairo Nights. Thank you for joining us.
It's always great to be here.
Coming up, of course, the random question robot will work to defeat our meager abilities to answer its myriad of questions. And then we'll be talking to Stacey Joe. Here's the fun part. Stacey Joe made a set of predictions about the Dolphins-Seahawks game. So did a couple of listeners, and so did a mystery person here at Cairo. We will see who stacks up as the winner. That'll be at the top of the hour coming up next. Random question robots right after the break. All right, welcome back to Cairo Nights, although it's not so welcome for those of us here in the studio because we have to do our evening challenge with the Crestatron 700, the robot that wants to thwart us with its questions. Are you both ready?
Random questions.
Always.
Always. Yeah, you don't sound that ready, Shane.
Not really.
Get readier. All right, because you don't have a choice. Here it comes. And because of your reticence about answering, you are going to go first.
Bring it.
What do you hope you still can grow out of?
Hope that I can still grow out of?
Yes.
Oh, gosh. I don't know. Maybe growing out. I have this weird leg shake that I've always had ever since a little kid, because I just always have a lot of energy. I'm ADHD, so I'm really hoping one day I can grow out of that. Because
does it irritate other people?
It irritates other people to death. Like, it makes people really
angry. I did that
angry.
When I was younger, too, and it irritated everyone around me.
Yeah, every time I talk to my grandparents or anything, I'll just be sitting, like, across the way from them and, like, shaking my leg, and they'll reach across the table and just grab my leg and be like, you need to knock it off. You're distracting. So if I can grow out of anything, it would probably be that.
All right. Frank?
I hope I can at some point grow out of my terrible eating habits.
Really?
When presented with, you know, the choice between something sugary and sweet and something that is good for me, I inevitably choose sugary and sweet.
You know, it's funny for me because I can walk past sugary and sweet without even batting an eye. If I didn't have, literally, I could tell you with confidence, if I didn't have candy the rest of my life, I wouldn't miss it. So, I'll still eat it from time to time.
Yeah.
Salty?
Oh, chips. Jeez,
that's a chips. Yeah. Like, chips are the... I don't even buy them.
Oh, because don't bring them in the house.
Don't even bother, because I'll just blow through a bag almost immediately. So mine is, what I wish I could grow out of, that I always had as a kid, was worry. Like, I'm always concerned about... Like, if even when I sort of, like, get this sort of, like, moment of sort of peacefulness in my head, I will then hunt through there, all through all, every box in my head, to find something to worry about. It feels like worrying is actually my compass needle at times.
There you go.
And that just, that's, I don't know that that's a terribly healthy way to live.
No, it's...
It's no, it's not. Frank, what do you wish your brain was better at doing?
I think high-level mathematics. I mean, I was one of those kids. I always got A's in math. I did just fine all the way through, but I don't retain it, right?
Right.
So I never went on to calculus because it was like, why bother? Because I just don't – I can't keep those, you know, the concepts. I'd have to go back several pages in the book in order to pass a test and then continue. So, yeah, that would be something that I think I would really – really enjoy being able to do.
Shane?
Frank stole my answer, so I'll go with my number two answer. Reading. Has always been really hard for me because I'm dyslexic. I've been able to do pretty well with it as I've gotten older. I usually have to read stuff twice.
Right.
So I really wish that I didn't have to, like, sit and focus so hard to read something and try to actually retain it. And also, I want to be able to, like, read for fun. I want to be that person that reads books and is, like, an intellectual. They're like, I'm sitting here and this is, like, fulfilling. I want to be that person,
right.
But I can't because it's just so hard for me to read.
Wow. That's such a part of my childhood. I can't imagine. And not have, because that was entirely my childhood, was reading. You know, like, that was the thing, and it would be, that would be like losing a limb, you know, in a weird way. So for me, what I wish my brain was better at doing is compartmentalizing. I wish I could take something that was either bugging me or that I was bothered by and lock it away. Because I watch people here at Cairo. It's kind of amazing. Like, if you were had something bad happen to you in a newspaper newsroom, you could be cranky all day and no one would even know or care. I mean, most of the time people didn't approach you.
Yeah.
But you see these people who are, like, angry in the newsroom, and they walk in and throw a switch, and suddenly they're just, like, charming and funny on air. I'm like, how do people do that?
Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm. It's very, I mean, I know performers have to do it all the time. I am still dumbstruck by it. And I think, like, well, that would be something. I'm not sure that that's always a good thing. Sometimes knowing what's on someone's mind is good, but I'd say if I could compartmentalize more, I would dig it. All right, this is the final fast question.
Okay.
Let's let the machine actually spit it out. All right, this one will start with me. What is the dumbest thing I've done that actually turned out pretty well? I would say journalism. I actually ended up in journalism by filling out a bubble in a community college class elective form by mistake. I didn't actually intend on taking a journalism class, and I ended up in a journalism class. It was a pretty dumb move on my part, and actually turned out to be a pretty good move over, you know, the last 30-some-odd years. But I literally had no ambition to become a journalist until I filled out that bubble by mistake, went into class, and kind of dug it. Jane? Oh.
Dumbest thing I've ever done. I committed to play rugby at Central Washington University. I moved 750 miles away with the hope of getting a walk-on tryout. One of the coaches played for my old high school coach, said he'd give me a spot as soon as I got to Central. There was no spot for me on the team. So I just completely put all my faith into being like, I'm going to play rugby up here. Didn't happen. But in return, I got to go to Central Washington University. And I have no regrets about going there because I love that place.
It's a great place.
I love that place.
School. All right, Frank, quick.
First marriage, went into it impetuously. It lasted for a very short period of time. It blew up, and everything that followed in terms of relationships has been really good, particularly my current marriage and family.
And that, did you feel like that first one then helped the other ones?
Yes, absolutely. But when I was in the dark days, the first one was like nothing.
Nothing was good about this. All right. Well, thank you for joining us. Coming up, we're going to be talking with Stacey Jo, and we're going to figure out whether or not she is as excellent this week as she was last week in making predictions about the games. This time it was Dolphins and Seahawks, coming up after the break.